welcome back to the program. From Mata Hari to Nathan Hale to Herbert Philbrick, each had what George Smiley called the ability to survive by virtue of an infinite capacity for suspicion. In the modern world of espionage and counterterrorism and post-Cold War engagement, our guest today, Henry Crumpton, stands astride that list. He knew he wanted to be a spy from the age of 10. He knew that sometimes you had to do things in order to find the reason for them. He seemed to innately understand from his early missions in Europe to the successful CIA war against the Taliban in 2001-2002 that sometimes our actions are questions and not answers, but it was always guided by the true north of his moral compass. Henry Crumpton served as the coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. Department of State from 2005 to 2007. For most of his 24 years, he operated in the foreign field, including assignments as chief of station in Washington. He served at the FBI as deputy chief of international terrorism operations. He was deputy chief of the CIA's counterterrorism center, led the CIA's Afghanistan campaign in 2001-2002, and was chief of the CIA's National Resources Division from 2003 to 2005. He's a graduate of Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the recipient of numerous awards and medals, including the Distinguished Intelligence Medal, the CIA's highest award for achievement. It is my pleasure to welcome Henry Crumpton to this program to talk about his memoir, The Art of Intelligence, Lessons from a Life in the CIA's Clandestine Service. Henry Crumpton, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, thanks for the opportunity and thanks for the great introduction.
Delighted to have you here. For somebody that has spent most of his career, if not all of it, playing things pretty close to the vest and in the clandestine service, as we'll talk about, why a book? Why now?
Well, I think that given the growing complexity of risk and threats and enemies that we face, intelligence is going to be of more importance, of greater value, and the American people need to understand about intelligence, and not just the citizens, but also our policymakers and the end users of intelligence.
One of the things you talk about is that intelligence has taken on an even greater role today, and we think of it in terms of a lot of espionage during the Cold War era, but in the kind of wars that we're fighting today, wars that are much less, as you say, kinetic, that intelligence takes on an even greater role.
I think so. If you look at the asymmetry of power, the growing role and proliferation of non-state actors as threats, but also as allies, this global battlefield, if you will, there's increasingly another world between conventional diplomacy and conventional law enforcement and conventional war. And what you see now in Afghanistan, you look at the challenges we have from Iran and how they use proxy forces like Hezbollah. War is increasingly more like managing disease than armies fighting armies.
Is espionage still as murky a world as it was during the Cold War in this new asymmetrical world we live in? Is it still as much the kind of thing that Le Carré once referred to as a moral twilight?
Jeff, it is, particularly talking about human intelligence, and I spend some time in the book exploring this. When you meet a foreign national and you assess and develop and you recruit that foreign national to spy for America, to spy for the CIA, it's not only an operational and legal issue, it is a moral issue.
Talk about that, the ways in which you or others work around those issues.
Well, and again, I explain some of this in the book. If you look at the various motivations of these foreign nationals, money, ideology, compromise, ego, revenge, and in some cases, particularly counterterrorism, coercion is a motivation. It's usually a jumble, a mix of these different motivations, and how you seek to understand this and then how you find a fit with what U.S. interests are, that's the challenge.
One of the things you talk about in The Art of Intelligence is how you learned a lot of this or the underpinnings of this while you were working in Africa.
Yeah, I had 10 years in Africa, terrific, serving in different countries, and I never served in the U.S. military. And the experience I gained there in Africa, often from my sources, often penetrations of insurgent groups, really was the foundation for my work later on in Afghanistan and elsewhere in the counterterrorism mission. These Africans taught me about tribal politics, about insurgency, about war and was really the foundation for my efforts later on.
And what were some of the lessons that you came away with that were valuable in your operations later?
I think perhaps the most important, I learned that it wasn't just the data or the images on a satellite photograph. It was acquiring an empathetic understanding of what motivates men to fight. And this is nothing new. If Thucydides in the Peloponnesian War writes about this and the importance of pride, prestige, and honor, that perhaps was the most enduring lesson for me.
One of the things you talk about is that an extension of that, that modern warfare today is not just about terrain and the way we think about it with respect to conventional war, but it really is about the population.
Yes, it's increasingly a war about the people, among the people. Now, sadly, we still have the threat of nation states fighting nation states and armies fighting armies in a more conventional setting. But increasingly, you've got these new challenges, these new threats. And if we don't understand the human terrain, we're going to be shortchanging ourselves and our citizens.
Are we making the process too complex today with the degree to which the intelligence apparatus has grown by leaps and bounds, really, since 2000?
Yeah, Jeff, a great question. Before 9/11, you had a very paltry intelligence budget and some very limited authorities, and I explained some of this in the book. Immediately after 9/11, it seemed as if everyone in Washington was a champion of intelligence, and the answer was just to throw money at intelligence agencies and to create new ones. Right now, if you look at how we are structured, the intelligence community, I believe it's heavily Washington-centric, and I think it's too big, I think it's too cumbersome. I'd like to see it more streamlined and certainly with more of a field bias.
What did we learn then from your efforts in Afghanistan in 2001, 2002, and the success of those efforts? It seems that in many ways, even regardless of what the outcome has been since, and we can talk about that, we didn't really learn the lessons even of the reasons for success of that mission.
That's correct. In fact, if you look at the commentary today used by academics, historians, journalists, often they refer to the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11. And it was anything but. If, in fact, you look at the fall of Kandahar, which was the last urban stronghold of the Taliban, that was 7 December 2001, less than 3 months after 9/11. Then probably a quarter of al-Qaeda leadership had been killed. 10, 20, maybe even 30,000 of the enemy were dead. The Taliban were basically routed. At that point, December 7th, 01, there were fewer than 500 Americans on the ground. It was not an invasion. It was an Afghan victory. It was our victory. But I don't think we fully understand that. And that's another reason I wrote the book. It was about our partnership with the Afghan people. It was not an invasion.
Talk about that partnership, the CIA alliance with the Afghan tribal leaders, which really began well before 9/11.
That's correct. I talk about the first 90 days after 9/11, but really this was this foundation for this initial success was built over the preceding years. The CIA established an office dedicated entirely to the pursuit of al-Qaeda back in 1996. By September of 1999, when I got to the Counterterrorist Center, then we started sending teams into Afghanistan, CIA teams working with our Afghan allies to collect intelligence and to engage in some very modest covert action. And so for the 2 years before 9/11, we were able to develop an extensive human source network, had more than 100 sources in every province of Afghanistan. And importantly, we built a lot of trust and confidence with our Afghan allies.
And in fact, we're making an effort to go after bin Laden in 98-99, and in fact saw bin Laden in the late summer of 99.
Yes, this is a point in the book that's crucial. It's really a watershed because our human source networks had been reporting on the bin Laden location. Our policy masters in the White House were suspicious, were unsure of this reporting. And they wanted eyes on, so this led us to develop the Predator. at the time unarmed. And based on the human source reporting, we flew the Predator over a compound near Kandahar late summer of 99, and sure enough, bin Laden was there.
Talk a little bit about that. And in fact, while he was seen, there was no opportunity to go after him.
Well, we immediately reported our confirmation to the White House, to DOD, and the response was, well, it will take 5-6 hours for TLAMs, the cruise missiles launched from the submarines, to reach that target. And so they basically wanted to know where bin Laden would be 5 or 6 hours from now. And, of course, there was no way for us to predict that. And that compelled us, along with others, not just in the CIA, to arm the Predator.
What might have been a better follow-on to the success of your mission 2001-2002 in Afghanistan? What could the country have done, what could the administration have done that would have built on that victory?
Well, a couple of things. One, Iraq. We were, I believe, distracted by Iraq. A lot of attention, focus, resources flexed to Iraq, and that hurt us in Afghanistan. But secondly, it's how we think of war. That initial success was a hard power success, military covert action in partnership with the Afghans. And what happened is that not just the U.S., but the global community, I believe, failed to secure that initial victory. There was no rule of law, economic development. Now, there has been some progress, particularly in education, particularly among women, but we did not secure that hard power victory with other forms of power, building liberal institutions and helping the Afghans.
Should that have been the job of the CIA?
Absolutely not. The CIA is a very small organization, very focused, and our job was to find and destroy al-Qaeda. And we worked with our Afghan allies to basically unhinge the alliance between many of the tribal leaders and the Taliban so we could get to al-Qaeda. That was the purpose of our mission.
Talk about where you see Afghanistan today.
In some ways, it's heartbreaking because the Afghan people have such admiration for them, and they right now are governed by a feckless and corrupt government. They face problems on both sides with their neighbors, Pakistan on one side, Iran on the other. Nevertheless, Afghans are tough, resilient, smart people, and I think in the long term, I hope in the long term, they'll be able to pull through this. What's probably most encouragement is the empowerment of women in parts of Afghanistan. More than 3 million girls go to school now, and that's a powerful force against the Taliban in the long term.
Talk about the threats from al-Qaeda today.
Greatly diminished because of, I think, our initial success in 01-02 and the continuing work, including the killing of bin Laden last year by the CIA and the U.S. Navy SEALs. That was a great operational success. And it had, I believe, strategic importance. So some progress there. I am concerned about the expanded al-Qaeda safe haven in Yemen. And if you note, there have been three attempted attacks on U.S.-bound airliners, and those originated from Yemen. And there's full-scale fighting in the southern part of Yemen today. Concerned about North Africa, concerned about Somalia. But what gives me greater hope, I think, is what we're seeing across the Middle East and the Islamic world. I think that there's increasingly a rejection of the terrorist tactics of al-Qaeda, and people are looking to change, but in a different way.
There's also been tremendous success with these Predator drones that really came out of a lot of your efforts initially. Success of these drones in taking out other al-Qaeda leaders as well.
That's correct. Not only in South Asia, but in Yemen and elsewhere. The program really is a technical complement to the human source reporting, to the signals intelligence, to other imagery. First and foremost, the Predator drone is a collection tool. And I think very selective use of the Hellfire missile shots are important. But we need to keep that in focus, and we should never rely on technology to the extent it becomes a substitute for human source reporting and for relationships on the ground.
What has been the impact of technology in terms of Al-Qaeda and in terms of the networks that it's been able to establish, the ease at which information moves around the world today, very different than, say, during the Cold War?
Oh, it's been monumental, the change, and overall I think it's for the good. If you look at the tremendous economic growth worldwide, and a lot of that is directly related to technology, particularly the information systems. So overall, it's a great thing. It's advanced a liberal thought and liberal values. But within this dynamic, you see Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, of course, you know, taking advantage of it, whether it's in cyberspace or whether it's in advanced weapons development or delivery systems. And this just makes the intelligence challenge even more difficult, but I think we're up to it.
Talk a little bit about that in terms of where you would like to see more money, more effort put into this.
I believe that if we can find a different structure, a different way to project American power, particularly in what I call expeditionary environments, like Yemen, Somalia, parts of Northern Africa, parts of South Asia, to secure some of these initial victories, that's where we need to focus. We're getting very good at finding and engaging and killing the enemy, and very precisely. But that's only the first 10%, 20% of it. How do you empower those locals to secure that initial victory? That's where we need to, and it's not just money, but it's about the right people, the right incentives, the right field leadership, and the right political support to do this, and not just in Afghanistan, but in lots of places. That's where I'd like to see more resources devoted.
It's also about historical and cultural understanding, and you talk about that, the role of history in warfare and espionage.
Oh, sure. I give one example in the book. Right after 9/11, I had some naysayers in the agency and elsewhere in the U.S. government talking about the disasters of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, the British in 1848, and how Afghanistan is a graveyard of empires. But my response to that was that, well, this is not an invasion, and we do not seek to extend a U.S. empire. We need to look at local tribal history and local lessons from recent warfare among the United Front, Northern Alliance, the Taliban, and others. And so that's the history that I studied. I looked at local history, and with the idea of us becoming the insurgents and helping the Afghans overthrow these foreign invaders, the Arabs and Chechens and Uyghurs and Pakistanis who had come in and basically co-opted the Taliban. So history, and that's just one example, is critical to our understanding and to our strategic thought.
How much success has there been as a result of these efforts, the successful ones, in making political leaders in Washington understand this?
Well, I think some are particularly keen and do understand, particularly those that travel to Iraq, Afghanistan, to Mexico, to Colombia, to other places of critical interest to us. Others, however, are driven, I believe, by sort of preconceived ideology or quick domestic political gain. And that's another reason I wrote the book, to, if I can, help illuminate the value of intelligence to some of these policymakers.
And to what extent does there need to be in intelligence today an appropriate kind of transparency, congressional oversight, which you talk about?
I think the congressional oversight is essential. It's critical. And right now, it's uneven, I believe. I think for the CIA, it's not bad. I think for other elements of the intelligence community, it's pretty confused, particularly if you look at Department of Homeland Security and the dozens of different committees that have various oversight of DHS. And that, I think, needs to be rationalized and streamlined for sure.
And are there more and more turf battles that you see arising today among all these, as you say, Washington-centric entities?
Jeff, we'll always have turf battles in Washington. That's just the nature of politics. I do see greater success overseas, and that's why I urge more of a field bias, and I think that's why we had success in Afghanistan. It wasn't just the CIA, it was our partnership with Central Command, Special Operations Command, and of course our Afghan allies. And there are other examples of that. Law enforcement, the FBI in particular, the CIA, doing some great work together overseas. But you've got to have the right leadership, the right incentive, and the right resources for those people that are downrange so they can get the job done.
I mentioned in the introduction that you knew from the time you were 10 years old that you wanted to be in espionage, that you wanted to be a spy. Talk about what it's like trying to recruit today.
It's a challenge, but something that I found both fascinating and rewarding. Recruiting foreign nationals to spy for America really is the lifeblood of our espionage network, and each case is different. Each case requires a good listener, someone with, I think, a degree of empathetic understanding, and then someone who can help that prospective asset find a way that they can, to some degree, securely achieve their goals, whatever that might be. That's the essence of espionage, is understanding and mapping the human terrain and finding that common ground. And for me, the best assets, the best foreign sources were those that were motivated by a higher purpose. And I established some great relationships and have great admiration for those sources.
Is recruiting harder or different today than it was during the Cold War?
I think in some ways it's more complex and therefore harder. Again, the Cold War, it was more of a Westphalian nation-state system, and obviously we still have that today, and the nation-state will remain the most important organizing principle of international affairs. But as I noted earlier, you've got more risk, more threats, more enemies, particularly non-state, and very seldom can you meet those types of recruitment targets at a diplomatic reception, whether they're narco traffickers or terrorists or others. You've got to get to them, and sometimes just gaining access is dangerous.
And is there an inherent conflict sometimes in recruitment and in the work itself between dealing with a world that still has state actors but also is this asymmetrical world that we've been talking about? And sometimes those two don't always mesh.
That's right, and that's the complexity I talk about. One current example of that is Iran and how they use a sub-state actor like the Quds Force against U.S. interest, how they leverage Hezbollah, a proxy force, against U.S. interest. And we look at Iran, and most of the media coverage right now is the diplomatic effort, the nation-state diplomatic effort. But the most important ally we have against the Iranian regime is the Iranian people. And so how do we network? How do we empower the Iranian people? I think that's one of the most important elements. And you can look at Syria also. A lot of diplomatic nation-state efforts there in the UN. But ultimately, it's about the Syrian people. And how do we understand them? How do we work with them?
And is there a role today for multinationals and people within multinationals and the way in which globalization has played such a significant role in the world today?
Oh, Jeff, absolutely. When I talk about non-state actors, our most important allies often are non-state actors, whether it's the tribal leaders we work with in Afghanistan, 01, 02, or universities, or multinational corporations. As you noted, the media is increasingly important. Really, liberal institutions and entities such as multinational companies that are based on the rule of law and transparency, good governance, these are all powerful allies, powerful forces in globalization. And how we understand and work with these partners and prospective partners to secure the hard power victories I talked about, I think that's got to be more and more of our planning.
And are you optimistic about understanding coming from leaders here today about the complexity of the world that we live in, the world that you talk about in the Art of Intelligence?
It's uneven. Some of our policy leaders do have a global view. Others are very parochial. very selfish, looking after their own political interest. And one example of that is how some of our political leaders have focused on immigration. So against almost any kind of immigration. And that really is the lifeblood of our country. It's the fabric that makes us great. And now, at the same time, you can't dismiss what I think is a very serious threat from these transnational criminal groups based in Mexico, spreading to Central America and in the U.S. But when politicians basically seek to aggregate, pull all these under an anti-immigration political platform, I find that pretty pathetic.
You've retired from the CIA. What do you see as your ongoing role?
I left U.S. government service more than 5 years ago. I started a consulting firm. We help multinationals, investors in emerging markets, help them manage risk and maximize the opportunity. And in just another way, try to provide a service to people in these emerging markets, whether it's infrastructure, energy, or healthcare.
Ambassador Henry Crumpton, the book is The Art of Intelligence, Lessons from a Life in the CIA's Clandestine Service. Mr. Ambassador, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Jeff, great questions. All the best to you.
Thank you.